This session is titled Rear Window, not after the Alfred Hitchcock classic movie, but rather for rich internet applications. And in this session, we'll be talking about building RIAs using Silverlight, Expression Blend, and an application architecture especially suited to building both Silverlight and WPF applications. That architecture is known as MVVM, for Model, View, View Model. At this point, you may be moaning, yet another bit of alphabet soup, yet another design pattern, and you'd be right. MVVM, though, is somewhat of the new kid on the block. 2 years ago or so, the acronym hadn't even been coined. So why is it important now? Why can't we just use tried and true patterns like MVC that have been around for decades? What is it about MVVM that attracts Silverlight and WPF developers? And how does Microsoft's tooling, Visual Studio and Expression Blend, support building applications with this technique? These are all questions I hope to have answered for you by the end of this screencast. First up, though, I'd like to provide a bit of an historical perspective of MVVM to show that it's really just a specialization and adaptation of common patterns and architectures you're probably already familiar with. For the next several minutes, I'm going to chat about a number of different application development paradigms. The terminology you see here is mostly attributable to Martin Fowler, one of the preeminent authorities on enterprise architecture. At the end of this screencast, I'll also provide some links to his work and that of others in this space. Let's start off with what is known as the autonomous view. This pattern, or anti-pattern some may say, saw its heyday in the early 90s with the proliferation of client-server and rapid application development. Using tools like Visual Basic, Delphi, and Power Builder, a developer, or even a non-developer, could be extremely productive in building sophisticated GUI applications. These tools provided a design surface with drag-and-drop and click-and-code semantics, again proving incredibly productive for the developer. Unfortunately, though, only a relatively small percentage of an application's lifecycle is dedicated to development, and when it came to maintaining, extending, and even testing these applications, things got tougher. The practices encouraged by the tools led to commingling of UI code, business logic, and data access all in one place, often the click event behind a given button on the window. Such applications are difficult to test, and fixing a bug or adding functionality to, say, the business logic means the programmer had to have familiarity with and perhaps modify the UI and the data access code as well, since they are also tightly coupled. One application development model that actually predated the client-server revolution, but didn't really gain widespread familiarity until sometime afterward, is MVC, or Model View Controller. MVC was developed at Xerox PARC at the end of the 70s by engineers working with Smalltalk. At the crux of MVC, and the other patterns we'll soon look at, are the separation of concerns and the well-defined interfaces between the main aspects of an application, namely the user interface, business logic, and data. In this diagram and the following ones, you'll see a number of arrows denoting control flow, but don't be too obsessed about which arrows go which way. Each of these architectural patterns has a spectrum of variations, and if you talk to 10 people about what a particular pattern entails, you'll likely get a dozen or so different answers. In my diagram specifically, the solid lines indicate an explicit action, like code you've written to invoke a method or fire off an event. The dotted lines indicate implicit or declarative operations, and data binding is the primary manifestation thereof. In MVC, as well as the other architectures we'll cover, the model is your domain data. It may be a SQL Server database, or it could be an Entity Framework data model, an XML file, or even a collection of web services. The view is the user interface and corresponds, say, to a window or a web page for the application. The intermediary is the controller, designed to handle the input from the view and carry out whatever functionality is required, likely interoperating with the model to make updates that are then reflected in the current or another view. In the .NET world, MVC has garnered significant attention in the last year or so with the release of ASP.NET MVC, which, like its predecessor WebForms, is an approach to building web applications. So why don't we just apply MVC directly to building Silverlight and WPF applications? Well, it turns out there are a couple of shortcomings in using MVC for such rich UI applications. First of all, there's a bit of a quandary as to where user interface logic should be placed. For example, suppose you have some type of a gauge widget, and you want to color its background as a UI cue. If the value of a given measurement lies between 0 and 20, the widget should be red. If it's between 20 and 80, it should be yellow. And if it's between 80 and 100, it should be green. Is that the job of the view or the controller? Is it presentation or is it a business rule? Well, it's actually both, but placing it in either the view or the controller blurs the separation of concerns. Another facet of rich interfaces, not present in the markup characteristic of web pages, is that the widgets used in Windows Forms, WPF, and Silverlight, controls like data grids and list boxes, are rather sophisticated and themselves blur the lines between view and controller. A data grid view, for instance, has both UI and controller logic embedded within it and might even be considered an MVC implementation in its own right. Acknowledging this mismatch of MVC to rich UI applications, in the mid-90s, folks at Taligent, and later the designers of Dolphin Smalltalk, twisted the MVC triad and came up with an adaptation known as MVP, Model, View, Presenter. In MVP, the model holds the same role as it did in MVC, but the relationship between the view and the controller, now known as a presenter, is a bit different. The presenter is a conductor, if you will, of the user interface. It has the job of the controller in handling user input, but it does a bit more and orchestrates the building of the view as well. The presenter has an arguably more active role in manipulating the view than the controller in MVC had, and is clearly within the purview of the presenter, for instance, to make the decision on what color to make the gauge widget in the scenario I presented earlier. As a result, MVP can result in a tighter coupling of the view and the presenter, which is why the presenter, and also the view, generally implement interfaces, making them easy to mock for the sake of testing. As with all these patterns, there are variations, and the one shown here is known as the supervising presenter. Note specifically the connections between the view and the model, and then between the presenter and the view. In the supervising presenter variant, simple view logic, for instance showing the first name field of a customer based on the first name field in the model, is handled between the view and the model directly, generally with data binding when available. More complex presentation logic, like my color-coded gauge, is the domain of the presenter. That, of course, leaves the architect with deciding what that dividing line between simple and complex is. And, of course, the simple may become complex as requirements change, all serving to throw a bit of a curve in attempts to maintain a strict separation of concerns. Another variant of MVP, known as passive view, seeks to be a more pure implementation, if you will, and relegates all presentation work to the presenter. That eliminates the ties between the model and the view, which does better delineate their roles, but it means the presenter and the view are doing a lot of busy work, explicitly getting and setting data to and from form fields, even when there's no manipulation or interpretation of that data required. In an attempt to leverage the best of both ends of the MVP spectrum, Fowler developed the presentation model pattern. It maintains the idea of a passive view, one with no explicit UI or business logic, but it modifies the presenter into essentially an additional model, namely a model for the view. The presentation model is then an adaptation of the domain model that exposes only the data required for the view, but also including UI aspects or properties necessary for the view. For instance, and continuing the colored gauge scenario, the presentation model would expose a property, say gauge color, and the gauge control on the view would then bind not only to the raw numeric value for the reading, but also to the gauge color property in the presentation model. The presentation model is still responsible for providing the information for the view, but it's a more passive role than that of the presenter in MVP. Here, data binding is the primary mechanism that implicitly correlates both data and presentation aspects between the view and the presentation model. From presentation model, it's really a small leak to MVVM, model, view, view, model. MVVM, itself a Microsoftism, is a specialization of presentation model that leverages some of the unique capabilities in Silverlight and WPF and their root technology of XAML, Extensible Application Markup Language. In the purest form of MVVM, the view is completely codeless. Both data and user interaction mechanisms are specified declaratively, and that's denoted here by dropping the solid line between the analogous view and presentation model components of the last slide. In MVVM, the sole connection between the view and the presentation model, or more precisely the view model, is essentially data binding. To recap then, MVVM is really just a specific implementation of presentation model. And it should be clear now, too, that presentation model, model view presenter, and model view controller are all already closely related, one merely evolving into another to address the differences between and leverage the mechanisms available in various presentation technologies. They all share common goals of managing complexity and enforcing the separation of concerns and applications. Now that you have a bit of an historical perspective on the origins of MVVM, let's spend some time applying that development paradigm to an application. I'll use Silverlight here, but since MVVM's enablers are primarily present in XAML, WPF applications also lend themselves well to the use of MVVM. Let's run the application first, and then I'll dig into its implementation and make some changes to it, noting the benefits of MVVM along the way, as well as introducing some of the features of Expression Blend for building Silverlight and WPF applications. My sample application enables the user to enter an RSS feed URL and presents a list of items in the feed. It also allows the user to select an item in the list to get the complete text for that item in somewhat of a master detail type relationship. The UI for the application is very simple and consists of only four user interface controls. There's a button and a text field at the top. The text field is the URL for the RSS feed. Here it's populated with the feed from a local TV station. Clicking the button causes the feed to be accessed, and a list box is populated with the titles of each item in the feed. Upon selecting an item in the feed, the full text of that item appears in the text box at the bottom. This user interface, of course, is the view in the MVVM pattern. The model for this application is the RSS feed, and the view model is that subset of the RSS feed shown in the view. namely the titles and the summaries, along with the URL of the feed itself. Let's poke into the code to get a closer look at this relationship between the model and the view model. Here's Visual Studio with the Silverlight project loaded. There are two projects here. One is the web application used to launch the Silverlight application, and the other is the actual Silverlight application, the simple RSS reader. I've created a view and a view model directory here to drive home the delineation, but keep in mind this is not something Visual Studio forces you to do. Note, I don't have a directory dedicated to my model in this case, and that's because the simple model for this application is encapsulated into a single line of code. The code to access the RSS feed starts here. In Silverlight, all access of web resources, here via web request, is asynchronous. So the request is initiated here, and the results, when available, are processed in the callback method receiveRSSResponse. An RSS feed is simply XML, so receiveRSSResponse accesses the HTTP response payload and pulls out the XML. .NET has a very convenient set of classes focused specifically on syndication feeds. So the line here converts that XML into a set of native .NET objects containing the feed data. This is where the model part of MVVM has been accessed. The view model for this application is much simpler than the model. We don't need all of the fields of a syndication item like the authors, copyright, image URLs, and so on. To strip out the non-essential model items and create part of the view model, the setFeed method creates a new collection of RSS items. Each RSS item comprises just the title and the summary properties of a syndication item, namely only the information required for the view. The collection of RSS items, in turn, is exposed as a property called RSS feed, along with the feed URL property, which is a simple string, and the selected item property that denotes the currently active element of the RSS feed collection. It's these three properties that form the public interface of the view model. You may have noticed that the RSS feed collection is specifically an observable collection. And note that the other properties in the view model also call invoke property changed, which is the core method of the iNotifyPropertyChanged interface. The specific view model class here is a descendant of a generic view model base class, which implements iNotifyPropertyChanged, and your own view model implementation will likely have a similar structure. So why all the attention to iNotifyPropertyChanged? It's a primary mechanism enabling data binding, part of the implementation of a listener pattern. In this case, the listeners are UI elements of the view, and what they are listening to are the modifications to the view model, or more specifically here, the feed URL, RSS feed, and selected item properties implemented on the RSS viewer view model class. In the view, note that there's a one-to-one correspondence between the user interface widgets, the URL text box, the list box, and the currently selected item, and view model properties via data binding expressions such as the one highlighted here. A binding expression consists minimally of a binding keyword followed by a binding path. The path is interpreted to be a property, or derivative thereof, of a class known as a data context. In this view, the data context of the user control element is set to an instance of the RSS viewer view model class, which is created automatically via the default constructor. Since the data context here is associated with the user control element, the outermost element of the user interface hierarchy, all elements below user control in the hierarchy, including the text box and the list box, inherit that same data context, unless they were to override it, which doesn't occur in this simple example. Since the data context is set to be an instance of the view model class, it follows then that the path for each of the binding expressions, feed URL, RSS feed, and so on, is a property of that same view model class, namely RSS viewer view model. So with the setting of the data context to the view model class, the binding paths referencing properties of the view model class, and the implementation of iNotifyPropertyChanged by those view model class properties, the data binding of the view to the view model is complete. And it's all occurring with essentially no code behind the view. What little code there is here is again the minimal amount necessary to instantiate the UI. This again is MVVM nirvana, no code in the code behind file. Since there's this nice separation between the view and the view model, I'm going to put on my designer hat now and spend some time in Expression Blend, working solely on the view, without impacting or being impacted by any of the code in the view model or the model. If you've not worked with Expression Blend before, one way to describe it in keeping with the theme of this presentation is as a view, and the view model here is the application's solution files. Note on the right is a familiar hierarchy of items. These are the same code and XAML files you just saw in Visual Studio, but you're getting a different view of them here. Visual Studio presents a view oriented towards developers, with a sophisticated script editor, IntelliSense, debugging capabilities, and such. Expression Blend presents a view oriented to a user interface designer, with an emphasis on setting properties such as color gradients, styles, and transitions via the Visual State Manager. Here in Blend, for instance, you can see a design view of our user interface. In Visual Studio 2008, this view doesn't even exist. You can only work directly with the XAML there. That's changing, though, with Visual Studio 2010. The UI presentation here, though, still isn't ideal. Because of the dynamic sizing of controls, the list box appears as a sliver of white. While I can set properties to overcome that, there's still something missing. It's hard to get an idea of what the application will look like without some real data in the controls. Expression Blend does support the familiar F5 keystroke to run the application, and that will invoke the view model in the model, which is great. But one of the benefits of MVVM is being able to develop the various aspects of the application in isolation. What if the model or view model happened to be in a state of disrepair when the designer is trying to do her thing? One option is to mock the view model. Provide an alternate representation that doesn't exercise the real code, but provides the services needed by the view. That alternate representation could actually be a static resource in XAML. And with Expression Blend 3, there's a really neat and simple way to set that up, via sample data. On the Data tab, I can set up a new sample data source, which under the covers is an XSD and XML file containing mock data. For MVVM, I need to create a sample data source that mimics my view model. First, I'll create a new sample data source and just keep the default name. I don't want to use that data at runtime. It's only for design purposes, so I'll uncheck the option here. This gives me a start at a sample data source. For my view model, I need a feed URL property, so I'll add that. The default data type is string, which is what I need, but it's a URL, so I'll change the format to website URL, which will provide mock data that looks like an HTTP URL. The default data source already provided a collection, so I'll just rename what was generated. Both fields of the RSS item, namely title and summary, should be strings. I'll use the lorem ipsum format and adjust the word length and number of words to be representative of real data. If I want to modify the generated data, I can, since it's all just XML under the covers. I could even import more representative data from a test or production database. Sample data source is now our design time view model, so it needs to be associated with the view. In the real application, this was accomplished by data binding, and the data context was associated with the RSS view or view model class. Since the sample data source here uses the same structure for the view model, the bindings will work automatically. All that needs to be done is assign a different data context. In Blend, that's as simple as dragging the sample data source onto the element on which to define the data context. Here, the user control at the top level of the UI hierarchy. Once I do that, the design representation changes to include the mocked data. Yet at runtime, the real data is still retrieved. Now that I, as the designer, have something a tad more real to look at, it's time to beef up the user interface. In Silverlight and WPF, controls are what are termed as lookless. They really don't have an inherent look and feel, just behavior. Of course, we need to see something, so the default appearance of controls are the ones we'd expect from legacy Win32 and web applications, the Battleship gray buttons, simple drop-down lists, and so on. To work on the R of RIA, designers style the controls via a series of templates. With templates, a control can take on virtually any shape. No longer does a list box need to be a linear presentation of text. It could include images and buttons arranged in a spiral, for instance, essentially taking on whatever vision the designer may have. In this case, my designer vision isn't all that acute, but I'll walk through some of the features and options at your disposal within Expression Blend to jazz up your user interfaces. Let's focus on the list box element in our interface. Right now, it's a bit bland with simple text on a white background, the default look for the control. Within Blend, the designer has access to a number of different templates depending on the control. A list box has four templates, one that is the control template itself, and three for other aspects of the control, such as the inner container and the individual items in the list. I'm going to make some modifications to a few of these to show how you can significantly change the look and feel, yet not impact other parts of the application, all due to the separation of concerns at the forefront of MVVM. First, I'll modify the Items panel, which defines how list box items are arranged within the control. By default, it's a vertically oriented stack panel, which provides the familiar list display. I'll leave the general format the same, but add a gradient background to the stack panel to provide a little pizzazz. The modifications I've just made have all been captured as XAML, as you can see here. So I could have done the same thing in Visual Studio just by editing the XAML directly, but it would have been a lot more painful to do so. Next, I want to modify how each item in the list box is displayed. Currently, I just show the title, but requirements have changed, and now the end user wants the title and then the complete summary below it, indented and italicized. To carry out this change, the item template needs some tweaking. Currently, the item template contains a single text block, so I need to add another below it. I can't do that directly, though, because the template can only contain one visual element. That visual element, though, can be a container, such as a stack panel, that itself contains other elements. So I can use the group into option to create a stack panel around the existing text block. Then I can add the second text block to the stack panel to display the summary text for the RSS feed. Next, I'll set the data binding for the new text block, indent it a bit, and italicize it. I'll also adjust the stack panel width to auto size, and then just for fun, transform it to be upside down. It works, but it's not too readable, so let's flip the text upright whenever the mouse passes over an element in the list box. That's where the final template comes in. This template enables a number of visual states, as shown in the property sheet at the upper left. The template itself exposes not only the contents of the list box item, namely the content presenter, but also the colors used to highlight the items. Fill color is the color used when the mouse is over an item, and fill color 2 is used for the selected item. Focus visual element defines the border for the selected item. Here I'm only going to deal with the content presenter and modify one of the visual states, namely the transition between normal and mouse over. Once I select the content presenter and the desired state, Blend goes into a recording mode, and changes made to the elements are defined as part of a keyframe animation that will play whenever the user transitions between the defined states. The animation here is simply to flip the current item over so that it's readable. And so that it's not such an abrupt change, I'll make the transition last for half a second. Now when I run the application, I get the desired effect, and each item is readable as the mouse moves over it. Let's move back to the slides now. In terms of MVVM enablers, I started by talking about data binding, which involves binding expressions and the data context property of the framework element class. I then leveraged the design time data context by stubbing in a sample data source, which is a new feature in Expression Blend 3. Then I put on my designer hat and changed the look and feel of the application via data and other templates, solely in Expression Blend and XAML, demonstrating again the separation of concerns that the MVVM pattern helps support. One thing is missing though. When I click that Get Feed button, it obviously launches the request for the RSS feed, and it puts the model and view model in motion. But recall that when I showed the code behind the view, there wasn't anything there that would ostensibly fire off, say, a click event. The magic behind this is something called commanding. This slide shows a snippet of the actual code in my application, and the relationship of the view and the view model that makes commanding yet another declarative operation. At the crux of commanding is the iCommand interface. iCommand is valid given the current context of the application. You might use can execute to disable a button or menu option that doesn't currently apply, such as a paste operation when there's nothing in the copy buffer. In WPF, iCommand is supported by multiple controls, including the button, menu, and hyperlink. But in Silverlight 3, while the interface is there, no UI elements currently support it. That changes in Silverlight 4, but for this application, I needed to overcome the lack of an iCommand implementation. There's a few ways to do so, and the one I've used here comes from Prism, more formally the Composite Application Guidance for WPF and Silverlight from Microsoft's Patterns and Practices team. Prism is designed for large, composable enterprise applications, so it's overkill for this small demo. However, there are pieces of Prism that can be used in an a la carte fashion for any application, and its support of commanding is something that I've leveraged. Prism provides a class called Delegate Command, which implements Silverlight's iCommand. For this application, I've created another property, getRSSFeed, which joins the feed URL, RSSFeed, and selectAnItem properties as part of the view model. That property is initialized in the constructor of the view model to point to the implementations for each method of the iCommand interface. The execute property of the delegate command instance points to the existing sendRSSRequest method, the one that spawns the web request and processes the RSS feed. The canExecute property points to a method that returns false if the feed URL text box is empty. That is, the button will be disabled whenever the URL is blank. In the view, then, I simply need to hook up the buttons command with the new delegate command property via XAML. Since Silverlight buttons don't have explicit support for iCommand, I used markup extended via Prism. That's where the prism:click.command attribute comes in. To support the inclusion of commanding, this application also references two assemblies that are part of Prism, Microsoft.practices.composite and Microsoft.practices.composite.presentation. As I mentioned, there's a number of alternatives for providing commanding support in Silverlight applications, starting with just implementing them in the code behind, to using Prism, to waiting for Silverlight 4, which is in beta now and supports iCommand natively. As I close this presentation, I'd like to offer a number of links to more information on the MVVM pattern and implementations in both Silverlight and WPF. If you're interested in the evolution of the various architectures that I discussed at the beginning of this CPF or Silverlight application and want to pursue an MVVM implementation, consider using a framework such as those presented here, in addition to others that have since appeared. The frameworks provide Visual Studio templates and other helpers to facilitate your development efforts. Finally, if you're the show me type that likes a deconstructive approach, there's a number of larger applications, complete with code, that you can use as references for implementing MVVM. Prism Stock Trader is a fairly substantial one, so it may be overwhelming as a starter application. In contrast, the VM Workshop tackles a smaller application scenario, but it's unique in that it applies MVVM to a variety of technologies, Silverlight, ASP.NET MVC, WebForms, WPF, and Windows Forms, so you can get a good idea of how the various UI choices impact the application of MVVM principles. In the time since I've created this presentation, I've seen a number of additional blog postings and other references on MVVM. So I'd encourage you to survey what's out there now as well to best leverage the state of the art and the state of the practice as you embark on your own applications. As always, thanks for joining me, and have a great rest of your day.